We can open up Revelation chapter 12. Begin a new chapter. Now, if you remember, as we saw, chapter 11, somewhat of an interlude, chapter 10 and 11, an interlude between the 6th and 7th trumpet. And then toward the end of chapter 11, there was the 7th angel sounded. In other words, the 7th trumpet was sounded. And this just was met with rejoicing and worship in heaven. And they were rejoicing and worshiping and looking forward to the imminent establishment of the kingdom of God, the long-established kingdom, the kingdom that's been promised, that's been foretold, that's been talked about since the early days of the Old Testament. This is what the people of God have looked forward to, is God's kingdom on earth. So it's somewhat ironic to see all this rejoicing going on when we realize what the seventh trumpet really does. The seventh trumpet initiates the last seven judgments, the seven bowl judgments, which are the most intense, the most horrific, and the most devastating of all the judgments that have been, they're going to be carried out up until this point. But there's no description in the last few verses of chapter 11 of what this seventh trumpet is. It just announces the seventh trumpet. And then there's this praise. So before we see what the seventh trumpet is, these bowl judgments, in order to fully understand the bowl judgments, we need to understand what led to them. And that's what chapter 12, 13, and 14 are all about. They give us and show us the spiritual forces that are behind these temporal judgments and the spiritual forces, the activity that led up to these judgments that are being poured out. So chapters 12 through 14 are really just the background of the bowls. As we see, chapter 12, it begins with the original rebellion of Satan. And what the consequence of this rebellion was for the rest of human history. In particular, the history of the nation of Israel. And then even more especially, as we get into chapters 13 and 14, the last 3.5 years of human history during the tribulation period before the coming of the Messiah's kingdom. So I'm just going to read the entire chapter of chapter 12, Revelation 12. It's only 17 verses, but we'll probably only get through the first 12 verses, hopefully. And a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, and the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. And she was with child, and she cried out, being in labor and in pain, to give birth. And another sign appeared in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads were 7 diadems. And his tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she gave birth, he might devour her child. And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who was to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was called up to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God, so that there she might be nourished for 1,260 days. And there was war in heaven, Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels waged war, and they were not strong enough, and there was no longer a place found for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who was called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down, who accuses them before our God day and night. And they overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb and because of the word of their testimony, and they did not love their life even to death. For this reason, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them? Woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, knowing that he has only a short time. And when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. And the two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman in order that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she was nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. And the serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman, so that he might cause her to be swept away with the flood. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and drank up the river which the dragon poured out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. Well, this first background information here that we have in chapter 12, it's really divided into three parts. The first part, see, is Satan's war against the Messiah. Satan's war against the Messiah. Remember when the Messiah was first promised? Way back, Genesis 3:15. God told Eve that the seed of the woman would crush the serpent's head. The serpent would bruise his heel, but he would crush the head of the serpent. And so Satan has been, since that very time, seeking to thwart the coming of the head crusher, the one who would crush his head. And so we see in the first six verses of chapter 12, Satan's war against the Messiah. And even that is going to divide it up. Verses 1 through 5 are talking about the past. Verse 6 is talking about the future. But then in verses 7 through 12, we see Satan's war against heaven. And then in verses 13 through 17, Satan's war against Israel. So here, the first part, Satan's war against the Messiah. Now the first six verses, again, provide the plot. They provide the plot for this entire background of these events. See, in verse 1, a great sign appeared in heaven. So we're back in the heavenly realm. And this is a great sign, a symbol. And what is it? A woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet and on her head a crown of 12 stars. Now, who is this woman? Who is the woman? Notice it's a sign. So it's not a literal woman. It's symbolic. The woman is symbolizing something. So, yeah. So, you know, it's not the Virgin Mary. Oftentimes you'll see the Virgin Mary portrayed this way in Catholicism, having the 12 stars, the crown on her head. It's not the Virgin Mary. Virgin Mary was a literal woman. This is a symbolic woman. It's not the church, because the woman gives birth to the child, right? And the child, obviously, is the Messiah, is Jesus. Well, the church did not give birth to Jesus. Jesus came from the nation of Israel. And really, the whole background for this description, and really, this is the only place where this type of description is given in the nation of Israel in all of Scripture. But the background for it is Genesis 37. If you look at Joseph's dream that he relates to Jacob, he kind of gets scolded by Jacob. But in Genesis 37, verses 9 through 11, Joseph's dream. It says, now he had still another dream and related it to his brothers and said, lo, I had still another dream. And behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. And he related it to his father and to his brothers. And his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground? So here, Jacob himself interprets it. The sun, the moon, the stars. The sun is representative of Jacob. The moon representative of Rachel. And the stars are the 12 patriarchs. the 12 sons of Joseph. So this is what it's going back to. The son, again, representing Jacob. And it's all going back to the Abrahamic covenant. This is the Abrahamic covenant. And so we see here, especially when we tie this in to chapter 11, verse 19, where we see the temple of God, which in its heaven was opened, the ark of His covenant appeared in the temple. We just see the intensely Jewish nature of the tribulation period. Yes, it is a time of God's wrath on the entire earth, but it is specifically and intensely Jewish because the whole program is centered around the nation of Israel. It's a time of cleansing of Israel, purging of Israel, to make them fit for the kingdom that was promised, and to be under the rule and reign of the promised Messiah, the Son of David, who would rule and reign. So we just again see the intense Jewish nature of what's happening here. So we have the nation of Israel. She was with child, and she cried out, being in labor and pain to give birth. This is her condition, and she's with child. The picture of Israel as a woman in travail in the midst of childbirth, or in the travail of childbirth, is a common Old Testament picture of the nation of Israel. I mean, just a few passages. You have Isaiah 13, verse 8. I'll just flip there real quick. But there are many other passages. Isaiah 21, verse 3. Isaiah 26, 17 and 18. Let me just look at Isaiah 13, 5 real quick. I'm sorry, 13:8. It says, and they will be terrified, talking about Israel. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. And then, of course, verse 9 begins, behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with fury and burning anger. So it's this picture of Israel as a woman in travail, and the travail of childbirth is a common Old Testament picture. And what were the causes of the pains for the nation of Israel? Certainly some of the causes of the pains is the persecution of Satan against the nation of Israel. But a lot of the travail was because of their covenant disobedience. You go back and read Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26, and you'll see God's promises to the nation of Israel, all the promises of blessing for covenant obedience, but then there are promises of cursing for covenant disobedience. And the nation of Israel, the history of the nation of Israel, is virtually just a reaping of the promised curses for covenant disobedience. And it's just over and over and over again. And this, again, it demonstrates the faithfulness of God. Because if God can't be trusted to keep His promises for covenant unfaithfulness, how can He be trusted to keep His promises for covenant faithfulness? So God always keeps His promises, whether those promises are for blessing or for cursing. God keeps His promises. So the nation of Israel has been in travail. The nation of Israel was in travail at the birth of the Messiah. There was a high expectation among the Jewish people looking for a Savior, looking for a Messiah. They're under Roman domination, Roman oppression. And even when the wise men, you remember, come to Herod and say, where's the King of the Jews? You know, we saw a star in the east and we've come to Him. And what does Herod do? Herod gets all upset and he calls for the Pharisees. He calls for the scribes. Say, where does the Scripture say that Son of David, the King, is going to be born? Well, in Bethlehem. And so there's this anticipation of a Messiah. Then in verse 3, John sees another sign. The first sign was the woman in travail. And she was in labor and in pain to give birth. She hasn't given birth yet. So again, all this is looking at the past. And in verse 3, another sign appeared in heaven. And behold, I'm just calling special attention. Whenever you see the word behold, you ought to underline it in your Bible, because it's essentially just saying, pay attention. This is important. It's just calling your attention to this. Behold, a great red dragon. A great red dragon. Great, just emphasizing it's very large. Then he exercises control, and we're going to see how much control he exercises, because he has control over a third of the heavenly host, a third of the angels that he takes with him. So it's a great red dragon. The word red is puros, or we get our word pyros, or even pyromaniac. It's referring to a flaming red, flaming red. But it's also the color of blood, which very well depicts what the intention of the dragon is. It's what? That he might devour the child, to murder the child. Further description of him, he has 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems. Now the word here is diadema. It's a royal crown, as opposed to Stephanos, which is more the victor's crown, which is what believers get. But this is 7 diadems, 7 royal crowns. Not the Coke, not the cola, just not RC and the moon pie. But he's got 7 diadems. What do these mean? Well, we're going to get into this much more when we get to chapter 17, especially verses 19 or verses 9 and 10. But just to get a glimpse over there and to give a kind of a tentative answer, but we'll get into more detail. In chapter 17, verses 9 and 10, John writes, "Here is the mind which has wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sits." That's the woman Babylon, the great harlot. "And they are 7 kings. 5 have fallen. 1 is. The other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain a little while. And the beast which was and is not is himself also an 8th, and is 1 of the 7, and he goes to destruction. And the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. So just in general, for now, until we get over to chapter 17, we can say that these 7 heads represent 7 world empires. And of course, Satan dominates these empires, these ungodly empires. Remember back in Daniel chapter 10, where the angel Michael is warring against what? The prince of Persia. And he has to go because the prince of Greece is coming. So these ungodly, these empires that specifically go against the nation of Israel are demonically empowered. They're demonically energized. So these 7 heads, or 7 world empires, the 10 horns is the last of these world empires, made up, composed up of 10 rulers, 10 kings, and it's all going to be in the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. And in verse 4, his tail swept away 1/3 of the stars of heaven. And this, these are just angels. We've already seen angels in chapter 9, verse 1. "The 5th angel sounded, I saw a star from heaven which had fallen to the earth. The key to the bottomless pit was given to him." So angels are described as stars often in Revelation as well as in the Bible. "So his tail swept away 1/3 of the stars of heaven, threw them to the earth." So this is just simply a description of Satan's original fall. And when he fell, he took 1/3 of the heavenly host with him. There was a war in heaven. Satan tried to exert his authority, exert his power, almost attempt to overthrow God. And he is so powerful, so persuasive, he persuaded 1/3 of the angels to join him in this rebellion. But they were thrown out of heaven. But there's going to be a second war in heaven, and that's what's going to be described in verses 7 and 9, which is going to be Satan's final attempt to overthrow the Messiah. But notice here in verse 4, Satan's original fall, so the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she gave birth, he might devour her child. See, the dragon's hatred is primarily against the woman's child, not the woman. And Old Testament history is just full of Satan's attempt to thwart the Messiah's birth, isn't it? Cain murdering Abel. Now, well, where's the head crusher going to come from? The seed of the woman was supposed to produce, was going to be the one that would crush the serpent's head. Well, Cain can't do it because he's a murderer. He's disqualified. Abel's dead. Where is he going to come from? When we look back over in Genesis chapter 5, at the birth of Seth, what does Eve say? Genesis chapter 4. And Adam had relations with his wife again. She gave birth to a son and named him Seth. For she said, God has appointed me another offspring in place of Abel. This will be the one. But then we have generation after generation. No one's coming along. And then we get to Lamech. Verse 29 of chapter 5 of Genesis. And Lamech has a son named Noah. He called his name Noah, saying, this one shall give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground which the Lord has cursed. Here's the deliverer that will deliver us from the curse. But it's not Noah. It's not Noah. And it becomes narrower and narrower, the focus. It comes to Abraham, Genesis chapter 12, the Abrahamic covenant. In your seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And then it gets defined even narrower to the household of David. And then to a particular person, the Messiah. But throughout Old Testament history, it's just full of Satan's attempts to thwart the Messiah's birth. There's Cain killing Abel. There's the corruption of the godly line of Seth to where their only righteous person left was Noah. Everybody else was corrupted. God has to wipe them out. Then there's Abraham and Ishmael. Abraham with Hagar trying to go about their own way and have the seed of Abraham. It wasn't God's way. And there was this attempt to try to usurp God's plan. Then we see all the murder of the males in Egypt by the Egyptians, right? And then there's the attempted murder of David by his own son Absalom. There's Queen Athaliah, who tries to wipe out the entire royal family. And then there's Haman's plot to try to kill all the Jews. And then there's the corruption of Solomon's line, to where no man from Solomon's line could ever sit on the throne. Well, who's the Messiah going to be? Who's going to occupy the throne of David if Solomon's line is cursed? Because in Jeremiah 22, verse 30, the line of Solomon has become so corrupt. And you have Jehoiachin. Verse 30, thus says the Lord, write this man down childless, a man who will not prosper in his days, for no man of his descendants will prosper, sitting on the throne of David or ruling again in Judah. So nobody from the line of Solomon, beginning with Jehoiachin, would be qualified to sit on the Davidic throne. Where's the Messiah going to come from? Now, you ever wondered why there's two genealogies of Jesus in the New Testament? You have genealogy in Matthew, you have genealogy in Luke. Well, Matthew's genealogy traces Jesus' lineage through Joseph, showing that Jesus has the legal right to the throne because he is the legal son of Joseph, and Joseph is an heir of David. But there's a problem because Joseph comes from the Solomon line, and no one from that line can occupy the throne. But Luke gives the genealogy of Jesus through Mary. And Solomon had another son, Nathan. And this is the line. So by blood, Jesus is qualified for the throne because he doesn't come through the line of Solomon. He comes through the line of Nathan. But yet legally, he's entitled to the throne as well. So here, you just see Satan trying to corrupt, trying to thwart the coming of the Messiah over and over again. So that when she gave birth, he might devour her child. And then you had Herod killing the children. You know, the wise men didn't come back. So every child, 2.5 years and under, Herod had killed. And then, of course, ultimately, is the cross. Jesus said, this is the time of the power of darkness. This is their time. The cross was an attempt to kill the Messiah. To devour the Messiah. To devour the child. So you just see it over and over again through biblical history. Even the temptation of Christ by Satan was an attempt to trip him up, to disqualify him from being the head crusher, the one who would destroy him. So this has been Satan's activity throughout history. But in verse 5, she gave birth to a son, a male child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. Where does that come from? Psalm 2. You know, a great messianic psalm. Psalm 2. Why are the nations in an uproar and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed. Let us tear their fetters apart and cast their cords from us. It's interesting. Peter quotes this passage in Acts chapter 4, verse 25 and 27, applying it to Herod, to Pilate, to the Jewish leaders. Verse 4, He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then He will speak to them in His anger and terrify them in His fury. But as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. I will surely tell the decree of the Lord. He said to me, Thou art my son, today I have begotten thee. Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as your inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron, you shall shatter them like earthenware. Now therefore, O king, show discernment. Take warning, O judges of the earth. Worship the Lord with reverence. Rejoice with trembling. Do homage to the Son, lest He become angry and you perish in the way. For His wrath may soon be kindled. How blessed are all who take refuge in Him. So the Son, this male child, is to rule all of the nations with a rod of iron. Not just Israel, all the nations. The rod of iron is a powerful. It's unbreakable. It's everlasting. It's a rod of iron. And a child was called up to God and to His throne. Or is this just the ascension of Christ? It's interesting, the word called up here. Her child was called up to God and to His throne. It's the exact same word, harpazo, which is used in 1 Thessalonians 4:17, talking about the church, that we will be called up together with the Lord in the air. It's where we get our word rapture from is really the Latin word for harpazo is rapture, and that's where we get our English word rapture from. You'll be called up. You'll go up just like Jesus went up. So this John's description here in Revelation 12, all these past events, showing all this background, Satan's fall, Satan's attempt to try to destroy the head crusher, before he ever comes. Just, it totally skips Jesus' earthly life. You have him being called up to God and to his throne. That's the ascension. And notice he's called up to God to his throne. That is God's throne. Jesus is not on his throne. Jesus is not ruling and reigning on his throne from heaven over a spiritual kingdom. Jesus will rule and reign on his throne. Remember what he told the church in Laodicea, Revelation 3:21, "He who overcomes, I will grant it to him to sit down on my throne, just as I overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne." So Jesus is not yet occupying his throne. He is called up to God into his throne. Jesus' throne is the throne of David. David's throne is in Jerusalem. It's an earthly throne, not a heavenly throne. Now, if David's throne was a heavenly throne, an eternal throne, why did God have to promise David an eternal kingdom if he already had an eternal throne? It's an earthly reign. An earthly reign. And this is what is being anticipated here. Jesus is not yet on his throne. So verses 1 through 5 are all in the past. Verse 6 is the future. "And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God, so that there she might be nourished for 1,260 days. Satan has to redirect his hatred. You know, he didn't get the child, so now he's redirecting his hatred toward the woman. And chronologically, this flight, the flight of the woman, the flight of Israel into the wilderness, chronologically, it comes after the war in heaven. Verse 14, "Two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman in order that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she was nourished." So this is just, verse 6 is just looking forward, looking future to that time. And again, it, yeah. Yeah, some people think this is actually because Israel actually did flee into the area of Petra. I think it was sometime around when Alexander the Great came through, and so they're trying to say that this was fulfilled, or this is talking about that event. But you know, that happened long before the birth of Christ. This is talking about a future event.
They're saying it'll happen again.
Yeah, there's actually Christian ministries who have gone to all the cliffs up there in the Petra area and placed Bibles into these cliffs so that when the Jews flee there, they'll have the scriptures there with them. But these seem to be believing Jews that are fleeing. You know, the woman, Israel, has fled into the wilderness. She had a place prepared by God to be nourished 1,260 days, 3.5 years. This is the last 3.5 years of the tribulation period. When there's a time of, it's the last half of the 70 weeks of Daniel, after the prince who is to come breaks the treaty in the middle of the week, the 70th week, and there's intense persecution. It corresponds with the time of the two witnesses while they're witnessing in Jerusalem. So this place has been prepared by God. You know, Jesus in Matthew 24, Jesus foretold of a future flight of the nation of Israel. In Matthew 24, verse 15 through 28, it says, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place." Notice, Jesus speaks of this as a future event, future from his time. Now, there's a lot of people out there who want to make the book of Revelation a book of history and referring to the fall of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., and so therefore they have to make the writing of the book of Revelation somewhere around 60, the 60th A.D., and it's all foretelling the fall of Israel, the fall of the nation of Israel, or the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. But there are those too who want to say that this occurred, this abomination of desolation, was when Antiochus Epiphanes slaughtered a pig on the altar in the temple during the Maccabean revolt. Well, this is back in the intertestamental period, the time 400 years between the Old and New Testament. But yet Jesus is talking about this as a future event. When you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who's on the housetop not go down to get the things out. So there's this future flight of the nation of Israel. It's not the church, it's Israel. Because again, Matthew 24 is all relating to the nation of Israel, not the church. The church isn't even in existence when Jesus speaks of Matthew 24. So again, we're just seeing this intensely Jewish nature of the tribulation period. Then there's the war in heaven. The war against heaven by Satan, verses 7 through 12. And it really just gives us another reason for Satan's rage against the woman. There's war in heaven. Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon. And his angels waged war. Now what's the significance of Michael? Well, Michael seems to be the guardian of the nation of Israel, the angel that is over the nation of Israel. And we see this even in Daniel chapter 10, when Michael is the one holding off the prince of Persia, the prince of Greece. In other words, these demonic forces that are trying to influence these nations to institute some type of persecution against the nation of Israel. But in Daniel chapter 12, verse 1, it says, now at that time, Michael, what time? It's the time of Israel's great distress. Now at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people. Whose people? Daniel's people. Israel. He will arise. There will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation. Referring to the nation of Israel. Until that time, and at that time, for people, everyone is found written in the book, rescued. So here, Michael is described as the great prince who stands guard. And he's going to arise, and he's going to arise in a time of intense persecution of the nation of Israel. So here there's a war in heaven. Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon. And the dragon and his angels wage war. They were not strong enough. There was no longer a place found for them in heaven. Now just the construction there, the grammar, no longer a place found, just shows a complete exclusion. Satan is completely excluded whatsoever from heaven. Now we know Satan has access to heaven, right? He's the accuser. He's constantly accusing believers. He appeared before God when he accused Job of sin. So this isn't talking about the original fall of Satan here, when he fell and took a third of the angels with him, because they still had access. They still went back. They were still accusing. You remember what Satan accused Job of? Essentially, he accused Job that the only reason he served God was because of what God gave him instead of who God was. And Job proved him wrong, that he worshipped God for who he was, not for just for what he gave. John continues description, verse 9, and the great dragon was thrown down. In other words, this is a forceful expulsion. And now John refers to Satan here with several different terms. The great dragon, that's what he's referred to him up till now. The serpent of old, that's just looking right back to the original fall, Garden of Eden. He's the serpent of old, who is called the devil. The word devil just means, in the verb form, it just means I defame, or I slander, or I separate. And this is what Satan does. He slanders, he defames, he's accusatory, and he's attempting to separate us from God. Who is called devil and Satan. It's just, Satan is just the transliteration of the Hebrew word Satan. And it just means, it's just referring to us, that's Satan's angelic name. Satan, it's light. He's a supernatural adversary. And he deceives the whole world. He was thrown down. I mean, this is the role of Satan. He's a deceiver. He deceives the whole world. What did Paul say in 2 Corinthians 14 about, you know, if our gospel is veiled, what is veiled to those who are perishing, whom the God of this world has blinded the eyes of the unbelieving, that they might not see the glorious gospel of Jesus Christ. So he is the deceiver of the world. But he's thrown down to the earth. And his angels were thrown down with him. Again, just this forceful expulsion. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying. Now who is this loud voice? Are they angels? Probably not. Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren, this isn't angelic, the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down, who accuses them before our God day and night. So these are probably the tribulation saints, people, the souls of those who are under the altar that we saw in chapter 6, who were crying out, how much longer, how much longer? And here you have these people who have been martyred, who have been killed through the tribulation. And they're the accuser of our brethren. He's been thrown down. And we just see Satan's unending accusatory work. Always accusing, always accusing. He roams the earth like a roaring lion, seeking to find something to accuse us before God. To accuse day and night. Then he says, and they overcame him. Why? Because of the blood of the Lamb. Not because they were better than somebody else. Not because they tried harder. Not because they were smarter. But because of the blood of the Lamb. Because of the word of their testimony. They did not love their life even to death. Now it was more important to be faithful to God. It was more important to pursue the things of God. It was more important to be obedient to God than even to live. They did not love their life even to death. Remember what Jesus said? Anyone loves their life in this world, you're going to lose it. It's just a biblical principle. Whatever you try to keep, you're going to lose. Whatever you give away, you're going to gain. It's just a biblical principle. He says, for this reason, rejoice, O heavens and earth who dwell in them. For what reason? The reason that Satan's no longer there, accusing. He's been thrown down. So the heavens are rejoicing and those who dwell in them. But woe to the earth and the sea. Seems kind of odd to throw the sea in there until we see what is happening to the sea. And it's just going to get worse. In the bowl judgments, woe to the earth and to the sea, because the devil has come down to you having great wrath, knowing that he has only a short time. And here we see Satan. This isn't the original fall. This is Satan's final attempt to overthrow the rule and reign of the one who's going to crush his head. Satan's final attempt to thwart the rule and reign of the Messiah. Because what happens after the 1,000-year reign of Christ? Satan's released, right? First he's bound, he's released. He leads another rebellion against the one who's the head crusher, but he's finally crushed. He's thrown into the lake of fire. So this is Satan's second to last attempt to try to thwart, to try to overthrow and to reestablish his position before God and to overthrow the position of the one who's going to crush his head. And this is the background. This is the background of the bowl judgments. This is the reason that these bowl judgments are going to be coming on the earth. It's because of this spiritual back, this forces that's been going on since the dawn of time. It's not prehistoric. You know, if you think about it, is there any such thing as prehistoric? No. Where does Genesis begin with? In the beginning. You know, there's no prehistory there. It's right from the beginning. There's no such thing as prehistoric. So this is Satan's last ditch effort. And this is why the judgments are coming. These are the bold judgments. This is the spiritual activity that's been taking place in the background throughout human history and will continue on into the future, right up in time, till the time the serpent's head is crushed. Well, next week we'll look at the war, Satan's war on the woman, verses 13 through 17, that lead up to verse 13.